The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Guardian Football Weekly. I'm Faye Carruthers, standing in for Max Rushton, who is away. So curtains have been twitched and raised and Arteta's Arsenal lift their second piece of silverware in a month, if we're even allowed to call it silverware. But what does beating the Premier League champions mean for their season? Champions League football is surely the aim. Maybe they should take tips from the dominant Lyon women, who made it five Champions League titles in a row. We still have a month of transfer speculation to go, much to Barry's delight. We'll talk Donny van der Beek. What does his arrival mean for Manchester United? Gareth Southgate has listened to the world and finally called up Jack Grealish to the England squad. But will he play? And if so, where? And if none of that entertains you, surely Jose Mourinho's emerging Hollywood career will, after his breakout performance in the Tottenham Hotspur documentary All or Nothing. All of that, plus your questions and a BT TV Football Weekly host super sub on today's Guardian Football Weekly. Well, as ever, we have a panel. Good morning, Barry Glendenning.
Hi, Faye. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Are you sick of the transfer window?
Absolutely, Faye. Well, I do my best to ignore it, which is kind of difficult when I'm regularly tasked with writing The Guardian's rumour mill. So I am part of the problem and can't really complain.
It is your job. Morning, Nikki Bandini. How is sunny Brighton?
Sunny Brighton is sunny, actually. Yeah, it's nice. It's been a bit cool the last couple of days. But yeah, I'm good.
And good morning, Barney Ronay. How are you?
I'm fine, Faye. How are you?
Very good. Very good. I wish I was looking at all your faces, not frozen on a Zoom screen. However, this will do. I would love to say let's switch gears and talk about actual football, but we're going to talk about a documentary about football instead, because the All or Nothing Tottenham Hotspur documentary has caused many a tongue to wag. It was just superb. Panel, who's watched it, who's loved it, who's hated it? I think I can guess in what order that is.
I mean, I thought it was great, but not for the reasons maybe you're supposed to think it was great. I mean, we're used to these kind of hagiographies now. You know, we all really enjoyed the Jordan one during lockdown, but you have to accept what you're being shown. Obviously, this is very much a Daniel Levy curated project. But at the same time, it's beautifully shot, beautifully put together. You get incredible access. And like any kind of piece of art, you look through the gaps to find out the truth. You know, you're faced with an unreliable narrator. So obviously, the very staged bits where, I mean, it's essentially a Jose vehicle. It may have started out as a Pochettino documentary, which would have actually been much more interesting. I'd much rather see a football film about how he built that really great Spurs team that we really enjoy. But this is something else. This is about the aftermath of that, where one guy who completely hogs the camera. I mean, you get watching the film why players love Mourinho, why media people fall at his feet, because he's just so charming. And even when he's projecting himself here as a kind of avuncular professorial figure in his glasses, like a caring, decent, and almost like an underdog. There are shots of him at the beginning, like, poor old Jose's here on his own, facing the world. At one point, he's running with Harry Kane on the training pitch, saying, come on, Harry, come on. It's like an absurd American movie about a college football star where his old coach teaches him how to play. You just can't help laughing and thinking, my God, this is hilarious. But it also made me think how great football is in terms of all those big, ridiculous, fat soap opera storylines. Everyone there is yelling and screaming. The manager soaked in the rain. The commentator yells something really banal. And yeah, that's right. And you realize nothing else matters outside that moment. And how, even though at the moment you might say this is ludicrous, overblown drama, what about real life? Actually, it is just brilliant. Just how huge the storylines are and what escapism it is. So I thought it was a football film and it was completely staged, completely overgrown. But hey, welcome to the Premier League.
I was really bothered by the conversation about how people put their toothpaste on their toothbrush. Like the little Dele Alli aside with the staff, people who didn't put water on after they put the toothpaste on the toothbrush, that really fazed me. I was not ready for that. But no, I thought it, you know, exactly the same as Barney. I mean, there's so much absurdity in it. And even the selling of it right at the top, this would be the most defining season in Tottenham's history. Like, really? They finish in a Europa League place. Like, come on. Like, it's a... a pretty underwhelming season in the grand scheme of things. It's an interesting season. I get that the José story is interesting, but I found it frustrating a little bit that the story was so quickly, like right out the gates, the Pochettino bit was done. Because I think if you structure the season as a season, he has a bigger part than we got. But as you if you structure it as a story, then of course the story is José, exactly as Barney says. Like that's going to be your narrative arc for the season. So I was frustrated not to get more Pochettino. My favorite bits are the bits where they're just sort of sitting and chatting and being normal. And I think that's really, I think that actually is important. I think sometimes in sort of the other great presentation of the Premier League is this impossibly glossy bit, which Amazon is contributing to. You do miss the sort of the normality of these people. Like everyone who plays football is still a person who still has bland conversations a lot of the time and talks about the same stupid stuff that everyone else does.
Do you think Pochettino watched it, Barry?
I don't know. If he did, he will probably be mildly put out by the fact that he, after the first 22 minutes of the opening episode, that's him, he's done. It was obviously started with, you know, to be about Spurs, but it quickly became the Mourinho show. I must say, find it as interesting as everyone else. What struck me about it was, apart from when they're playing, the utter banality of life as a footballer. Just, it seems so boring that a lot of sitting around, either eating or pedaling exercise bikes, having pretty dull conversations. I suppose it's a lot like any other workplace. We assume it's very glamorous, but it isn't. And the Spurs training ground, it reminded me of a Bond villain's lair, with it immaculately laid out with all these staff walking around in tight purple t-shirts or training tops, like you might see on a Bond movie. It will improve as their season unravels, because these things are always better when they're about failure. And I know that only too well, having seen three separate documentary series about Sunderland getting relegated in various seasons, all of which I thought were vastly more entertaining because they got the local community involved. They didn't have a narrator so much as local characters and players at the club and backroom staff narrating the documentary for us. So with only three episodes into this, Tottenham, I think they've only lost one game. Things are going quite well for them. But as things start to go pear-shaped, I expect it will improve.
I think like on the banality, I think that's really important and a thing that people miss about football all the time. It's one of the reasons I love these shows. I remember interviewing Espen Bardsson, the former Tottenham keeper, who quit the game partly because of that, because he just didn't like the life. He didn't like the life of being told where to be and what to do and just having massive sort of boredom in his life for a lot of it, because he's a smart guy and he went off and applied himself to finance instead, which seems boring to me, but obviously isn't to him. And I think that like then brings home a little bit also like the highs and lows of it as well, because when your life is quite boring in parts, like in terms of sitting around waiting for things to happen, training doesn't actually last that long. Then the moments like Eric Dier getting substituted, pulled off in that Olympiacos game when he clearly was quite upset by it. I think that becomes easier to understand when you sort of recognise how little of a footballer's job is the bit that they really care about, which is being on a pitch. That's all they really want to do.
But even the meetings in there, the meeting with Harry Kane, I thought was brilliant, where he calls him into his office and says, you know, Harry, let's have a big head-to-head, me and you, we're going to take this team forward. And he's like, you know, we can win. I feel we can win this because of you. And you see Kane look kind of pleased and like really flattered. And then he goes, you're all good players. And then Kane looks slightly disappointed. He thought he was talking about him. and then Kane goes for a hand clasp and Josie fist bumps him. And Kane's face again collapses in disappointment. It's kind of I thought the direction was like masterful. And then later in the team talk, he tells Dele Alli several times that he's not a good trainer. He doesn't train well. And everyone laughs. But that's devastating. I mean, that is a devastating critique of a professional footballer who's supposedly a £100 million player. That's there on the surface. I thought that was pretty amazing. It's kind of put in as banter. But there must be a lot of criticism of a lot of other players that aren't in that documentary.
So, listen, one last question on this, and it is purely because Tom Hardy was trending on Twitter simply for narrating it. I mean, Russell Crowe narrated the Leeds documentary, if I'm right. It seems like this kind of gruff narrator is fashionable at the moment. Could we see Sean Dyche perhaps narrating a Burnley doc anytime soon?
Tom Hardy actually narrated my cricket film From the Ashes, which I sort of helped write the script for. And I was really like, wow, Tom Hardy. But on that, he was much more kind of ruminative, and he had this kind of slow delivery. I thought his delivery on this was really good. I don't know if he's learned from his previous experiments with my overly wordy script, but I thought he was really good. I thought he was really snappy and got it. His sport film narration work has really come on, and I'm proud of him.
Did Barney just say he'll be delighted for all or nothing? Did Barney just sort of make that?
I think he's claiming credit for Tom Hardy's entire back catalogue.
Pochettino to his Mourinho in this.
Right, listen, we should probably actually talk about some real football, because just when you thought the season was over, it started back up again. Mikel Arteta's Arsenal capitalising on their recent FA Cup trophy. 28 days later, they beat Jurgen Klopp's Premier League winning Liverpool. Barney, you were at Wembley for the Community Shield. You saw it as a melancholy occasion more than anything else, though.
Well, it was, again, it reminded me a bit of the, because you're back to the documentary, it was very melancholy at the start, and Wembley was wet and damp and empty and quiet, and nobody really wanted to be there. But then sport has this indestructible quality. You know, once the game began, everybody became sort of sucked into it. There was no lack of commitment from any of the players or the managers. It kind of drew you in, and you remembered why sport's such a great kind of, you know, anesthetic to the real world, because suddenly you were in the middle of what I thought was a very interesting game for both teams and for their fans. I thought it was very interesting. I thought, you know, obviously it's a friendly, but it was a keenly contested friendly. It's hard to ignore the fact that Arsenal have got better. They really have, like, something to do with having a manager there who's obsessed with getting rid of the slack in that team has really pulled them together. They play with a lot less, they're kind of a fearless unit in a way at the back. The two lines are very close together. They break quickly. And they've got some young players who are really good. I thought Eddie Nketiah, I don't know if he's ever going to be Michael Owen exactly, but he gave Virgil van Dijk a really difficult game. Saka is so incredibly composed. I'm really surprised he's not more of a thing for Gareth Southgate. I think he's a really good young player. And he's got Aubameyang, who's a brilliant player, to run like a madman. And they were really good. And then we had Liverpool, who have got some issues. I think they're... The style and the pattern of play is something other teams will be more accustomed to this year, and you could set up an algorithm which would tell you where Liverpool are going to pass the ball, because they go through these very set patterns which are hard to resist, but they, you know, if you're not worried by them, you can prepare your team for them. And I thought that's why their goal scorer Minamino was quite an important person, as he came on and occupied some different spaces. And suggested that Jurgen Klopp, who was obviously miles ahead of me in looking at these things, is aware of that, and he found another way to attack, and I thought it changed the game a bit, and that was very interesting. And how Liverpool progress will be interesting to watch. So I thought it was a good game.
Peter Host on Twitter asks, Barry, two trophies in 1 month. How much can Arteta use that momentum going into the new season?
I think counting the Community Shield as a trophy, while it technically is shiny silver thing that's presented at the end of the game to the winning captain, it's a glorified friendly. But I think he has a hell of a lot to work with. Arsenal have steadily improved under his watch, and the style of play, you know, it takes a while to get accustomed to that, playing out from the back, possession based game, and they will only get better and better at it, one imagines. I don't think they'll be challenging for the title, but I certainly think they're in the race for a top four spot, and if I was an Arsenal fan, I'd be pretty happy at the moment, and they're a famously unhappy bunch, so it's nice for them to have something to look forward to. It looks like he's going to get rid of quite a few players, presumably bring in some more, and the big question is, can he get Aubameyang to sign a new deal? And he seems confident that he will. Aubameyang, having scored the winner, he seems pretty content with life at Arsenal, so if I was them, I'd just throw as much money as he wants at him, because replacing him or losing him would be a massive blow before the start of the season.
Yeah, absolutely does. It looks like Lacazette's going instead of Aubameyang, and as you say, he looked really happy. Also didn't drop the trophy, so, you know, winning. So we need to look at it from a Liverpool perspective as well, Nikki. Should Jurgen Klopp be concerned that Liverpool have kind of lost their invincibility cloak since the season was put on hold, so to speak?
I do think this season is obviously sort of different and particular, and there is perhaps something more relevant for both teams to always cut to Liverpool as well, in that there hasn't really been a stop for summer. This isn't really a restart point. This is just a continuation of how you were playing before. So there is a question for all teams now of how quickly and easily you can change gears. And so it's a benefit to Arsenal to be able to go from a cup final not long ago to playing Liverpool again and to keep rolling into the new season. And likewise for Liverpool, the question is, can you kick out of that end of season mode you might have been in? Can you sort of revert to where you need to be? I don't buy that I'm willing to go with this idea that there's an algorithm that could be possible for how you beat this Liverpool team. But I think that even sort of looking at the detail of this game, Arsenal's goal came from playing out from the back. But like seconds before that, Liverpool's press, which they're always going to do, they're always going to bring that high press on you, resulted in David Luiz kicking the ball out for a throw-in right next to his own corner flag. So the press is still working. Liverpool still had the better legs going to the end of the game. They were the team on top at the last part of the game. I'm not worried about them in some big sense. I don't think that because they drew the Community Shield, they're suddenly not going to be able to win most games in the Premier League. But I do buy something of this idea that this season could be different, and switching out of a negative headspace, if you want to call it that, could be harder than it would in a normal season because you haven't had time to sort of pause and breathe and reset.
Yeah, that makes sense. Obviously, one team pretty happy to see Liverpool fall at the first hurdle, you would think, would be Manchester City. And if, big if, they have Lionel Messi on their side, they might be hoping to regain the Premier League title. Jurgen Klopp himself has said that having Messi won't make City unbeatable, though. What do you think, Barney?
Well, I mean, it would be a weird scenario where you bought the best player ever and he didn't improve your team. But then, weird scenarios do happen. And there'll be lots of people who know a lot about football who will come up with lots of good theories as to why having Messi in your team, you know, could somehow weaken it, because he's like this dark star who just draws all the energy and attention into him. But the bottom line is he's just incredible. And the problems they've had at Barcelona are not to do with Messi. They're to do with how that club has been run around him and the players they've put around him and the way the team has been structured. So, in a way, if he were to go to Man City, it tells you that Messi is still obsessed with winning, because that's the place where he would go to win, with a manager who knows how to use him, to a club which, you know, hasn't won the trophy he wants to win again. So that would suggest to me that he, even though there's something absurdly nostalgic about going to play with Pep Guardiola again, it would also tell you that he's incredibly hungry to win. And I'm like a total convert to Messi. Everyone's a convert, but I literally believe he can do anything and that he is seeing the world in double time. So, if you put him in a very good team, which City are, that team is going to be a very, very good team. So trying to finish ahead of them in the league is going to be extremely difficult.
Yeah, well, Chelsea are certainly trying. They're spending a hell of a lot of money. Kai Havertz, the latest, expected to join in a deal which could reach £90 million, which is a new club record. Producer Danielle has written this. Will the new German, London side, be taking home trophies this season, Barry?
I don't think so, as things stand, because Chelsea aren't, in my opinion, particularly lacking going forward. It's at the back they need to shore up. And I'm not sure signing Thiago Silva on a free from PSG is going to be the solution to their problems. He's a terrific player, but he's getting on. He's never played in the Premier League before. And it's probably a cliche to say this, but perhaps a cliche because it's true. He's been playing in Ligue 1 for the last several years, and the Premier League is a lot more intense. So I don't know how he'll get on. I'm looking forward to see how he gets on. He may very well do a great job at Chelsea, but I'm not sure how many games he'll be able to play a season. If Chelsea don't learn how to defend set pieces and counter-attacks a lot better than they did last season, I would say there is zero chance of them winning trophies.
I think the interesting thing about Chelsea spending is the timing as much as anything. there's something to be said for buying a lot of talented young footballers when the market is not particularly healthy or confident, and when you have a billionaire in charge of your club who's pretty cash rich, not particularly worried about putting that amount of money up front, and when it seems like there's going to be a general rolling back of financial fair play constraints for that kind of thing, a general sort of softening, which was due to happen anyway, to be honest, before the City case happened, which massively undermined UEFA's authority on this. So I think what they're doing is not necessarily a kind of, we must win a trophy next season. I think it's probably smart investment in many ways. Chelsea sell a lot of players as well as buying a lot of players. Their model, commercial model, is pretty successful. And if there's ever a time to go out and stockpile valuable assets that you know are valuable because these are really good players, then it's probably now when no one else is bidding for them.
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating season because in many ways, I'm sure this would disagree with me, but I almost feel like what the season Lampard has just had is more straightforward than the one he's about to have, because expectations were low, because there weren't options to bring in these players, because you get that sort of effect, a bit like Jose on the documentary, of coming in and just being the guy and being someone who people are happy to see and getting a certain amount of enthusiasm behind you. And this is going to be more of a test of, are you the manager that you want to become? Like, are you sort of capable of integrating new players, of doing some sort of more complicated things, perhaps in terms of managing a squad and perhaps tactically as well? So I think it's a really fascinating season for Chelsea. It's definitely interesting because of that forced pause in transfer spending. It's interesting to sort of see that Roman Abramovich again, almost like after this sort of period in which we've got used to City being the big spenders. I mean, Chelsea were the original. Well, the original's probably going too far because you go back to Blackburn and keep spinning back and back. But they were sort of a defining moment, certainly in Premier League history, was Abramovich coming in and throwing money around. And I don't know, I think they're one of the most interesting clubs to watch this season. It's not really sort of making a prediction here or there, but definitely interesting.
Now then, one team that does look like it's going to have some interesting signings on the horizon, Manchester United, with reports as we're recording the pod today. Donny van de Beek apparently has had a medical at Manchester United. 23-year-old Ajax midfielder on the verge of a £40 million move. What do we know about him and how's he going to fit into the squad, Barney?
Well, I think when he's the kind of player who, when you think about fitting into a system, or you know, how do you get into this team, he's probably an ideal person for that, because he is a total Ajax product in that he's an incredibly clever and versatile and fluid footballer. I have to admit, I didn't know a great deal about him until I saw him in the doubleheader Ajax Spurs, which sometimes you have to see a player in the flesh to appreciate how good they are. And certainly in the Ajax's away game in that tie, he was fantastic. You just thought, wow. I mean, this guy's brilliant. He was so mobile. He was so confident in where to play, to interpret the game around him. He played three or four different positions in that very Ajax-y way. And you kind of thought, wow, why is everyone talking about De Jong? I mean, that was certainly how I left that game. This guy's fantastic. So there's been a bit of talk about how could you fit him into a team which already got Pogba and various other good midfielders. I don't think that would be a problem, because he's such an intelligent footballer. He's not going to say, well, I only play here. That would be absurd, because he's come right through that Ajax system playing, you know, with other fluid, versatile attacking footballers. And I think he looks like a brilliant signing.
I heard a Dutch football writer on the radio this morning talking about him. He said also personally, he's very laid back, chilled out guy, good team player, and, you know, will play wherever asked. I think he said he can actually play at centre half if required as well, which is handy. Particularly, I think, at Manchester United, where they might need one. But, it seems like a really, really good signing.
I really think in this, well, it's not even really post-COVID times, but certainly at the moment, bearing in mind the short turnaround in seasons, versatile players should be high up on the agenda for clubs to buy, because there's certainly, you could predict a lot of injuries this season for sure. Right, that's it for part one. Coming up in part two, Sid Lowe talks us through the Lyon Women Champions League win and the ever-growing bad blood between Messi and Barcelona. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. European champions once again, Olympic Lyonnais, sailed through their final against Wolfsburg on Sunday, putting to bed any rumours that they'd lost their dominant edge. So goals from Eugenie Le Sommer, Saki Kumagai and Zala Bjork Gunnar's daughter capped off another superb season for the French side and has left many wondering what exactly it's going to take to beat them. Sid Lowe watched the match and joins us now. Sid, any sign of Lyon giving up top spot anytime soon?
No, and I think the first half performance at least was kind of a demonstration of that. And you're right, there was a feeling coming into it that they hadn't been particularly impressive throughout the competition, albeit it's true that Wolfsburg had also been pretty fortunate to beat Barcelona in the semi-final. They were without Nikita Paris, who was suspended. They didn't have Hegerberg, who of course had not made it for injury. Henri wasn't able to play as well. So there was a whole series of absent players. There was a kind of a sense that, right, this is the moment. And even listening to some of Wolfsburg's players in the build-up to the final saying, this is the best season we've had. Obviously, this is poor old Wolfsburg, who've now been knocked out of the Champions League 5 years in a row by Lyon. Three of them in a final, two quarterfinals. They've always been close. And I think there was a feeling that, right, okay, this is possibly as good a chance as there's been. And although it's true that I thought Wolfsburg responded really quite well in the second half, that first half performance from Lyon, it felt a little bit like a team saying, oh, right, so it's like that, is it? We'll show you. And they were really, really good in the first half. And admittedly, it was only 2-0, but it could have been more. And it was more just kind of that feeling that you had that, okay, this is a side that's better and is going to demonstrate it. And in particular, Cascarino was unbelievable on the right side.
Love her as a player. I mean, Lyon's pretty much the entire French national team, isn't it? Yeah. They are just superb. You know, 3-1 it finished in the end. But was it quite as easy as that scoreline perhaps suggests?
No, as I say, it was the first half performance that felt like a statement. And then actually Wolfsburg really took a step forward in the second half. And one of the things that really struck me about Wolfsburg in particular, and I know it's partly about context and partly about opponents, but in particular against Glasgow, the kind of the physicality of them, the athleticism of the speed and how direct they were. And when the pitch opened up in the second half, particularly on the left-hand side where Rolkov really started running at Lyon, and that meant that we saw Lucy Bronze forced into kind of a defensive role, because obviously we're used to watching Lucy Bronze be brilliant as a fullback because she gets up the pitch so much. But here she is in a position where she was kind of forced to defend and actually responded really quite well. And so was it as easy as that? No, because Wolfsburg's response was good. And yet at the same time, it is true that for all the pressure, for all the fact that Wolfsburg took control of the ball, for all the fact that they started finding space to run into, in terms of really clear chances, I'm struggling to think of more than one or two. And so in that sense, I suppose Lyon could argue, well, look, it got back to 2-1. And yes, it was a bit nervous, but actually we didn't allow them to do very much. And then, of course, they got the third. What was it? 5-6 minutes from the end, possibly a little bit fortunate, but they got the third and won it. I guess in terms of kind of a broader question about whether this will continue, I think it was on BT, so you probably heard it. I think it was Lucy Bronze after the game was saying, you know, no one will ever do this again. You know, no one ever will ever win 5 in a row again. And actually, I think that was a recognition, not just for the fact that what they've done is extraordinary, but the margins are narrowing slightly, that the money is being distributed slightly. I mean, the very fact that, for example, Benil Harder is on her way to England. The you know, Chelsea spent, I think it's €300,000 on her. That Lucy Bronze is leaving, for example. And I think it does feel like the kind of the financial balance is shifting slightly. And obviously, eventually, that will have an impact. Whether it happens straight away, obviously, is a different question. Because as you've rightly pointed out, Lyon, while they have the biggest budget in Europe, quite a lot of their players are French. Quite a lot of their players are coming through their own system. This isn't only, although there's quite a lot of this as well, this isn't only a really big club going and buying everyone else's best players.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting next season. Obviously, Manchester City and Chelsea are going to be playing Champions League football next season. And it really looks very much as if both teams are gearing up to challenge Lyon for that title, which will be really, really exciting. Let's move over to Spain, though, Sid. Messi not playing ball. Sorry about the pun there. But bit of a split with them and Barcelona. Mm. Just defying everybody now. What's the latest?
Well, in a way, the latest is that there isn't a latest, if you see what I mean. And the decision to communicate his desire to leave via a formal letter, what everybody now knows as a bureau fax, which is essentially kind of a recorded delivery, which is a way of saying, I'm serving notice of my intention to leave. And built into that was the belief from Messi that he was taking the unilateral decision. In other words, he's gone. And so in that context, the decision not to turn up for pre-season medicals, in particular, of course, the coronavirus test, and then not turn up to training on the Monday, in that context, that decision is entirely coherent. Because in a way, if you're expressing the idea that I have gone and I've unilaterally taken this decision to go, if you then turn up to training, it makes that statement somewhat less clear. And so the situation is that everybody is kind of stuck now. So Messi is stuck because, of course, he says, right, I'm going. But to force that through now would possibly require a legal battle of some sorts that's in no one's interests. Barcelona are kind of stuck because they're saying, no, you're not going. And you have a clause in your contract, which means if anyone wants to sign you, they have to trigger the 700 million buyout clause. And obviously, there's an argument over whether that's valid. But they're kind of stuck because there's no point in having a player who's unhappy, a player who's made this kind of statement, and a player who, by the way, can go in a year's time anyway. So Barca are stuck, Messi are stuck. And actually, on a lesser level, City are partly stuck in that they now have some degree of moral obligation to help Messi see this through. They can't just leave him hanging. And so now we're in a situation where you've got three positions, I suppose, call it 2.5, because City are sort of not involved, but they are. Two positions that are completely at odds with each other, but ultimately, to use the lovely Spanish phrase, which is now condemned to understand each other. And at some point, there's going to have to be some sort of resolution, because right now, there isn't one.
But perhaps not an understanding from the fans, though, because, you know, I can understand exactly your point of why he didn't turn up to training. But those Barcelona fans that have followed him for years and absolutely worship the ground he walks on are going to be devastated.
Yeah, they are going to be devastated. But curiously enough, or perhaps not curiously enough, that hasn't necessarily translated into fans being against Messi. Now, look, of course, there are a lot of fans who think that this hasn't been particularly well handled. There are a lot of fans who are upset with him, but I would be willing to bet that the immense majority of Barcelona fans think, look, Messi has effectively earned the right to walk away. Of course, we don't want him to. And of course, we're upset that he's going to, and we're upset that he's going to do it like this. But I actually think if this becomes a question of apportioning blame, and by the way, it does, and that's one of the reasons why it's being handled this way, because it's not just about resolving this. It's about resolving this and saving face. It's about resolving this and not being the bad guy. I think most Barcelona fans are pointing the finger squarely at the president of Mario Bartomeu and at the board of directors, not at Leo Messi.
Can I just ask Sid, one thing I've not quite got is exactly why that is the case. Like, why is there so much talk about Messi being betrayed? And why is all the sympathy apparently on Messi's side, where you've got a player who's been extremely well treated by his club for his entire career, yeah, extremely well paid, given a kind of executive presence. Obviously, he's the greatest player ever, so that helps. Given this kind of executive presence, he's now refusing to turn up to training. He's kind of dropped this I want to leave bomb in the middle of the why? Like, yes, there have been lots of bad purchases, you know, £1 billion on players that have. But how is that in any way a betrayal of Lionel Messi, that he's allowed to act all huffy and as though this is a cause he must fight and how dare you betray me? I don't quite get that. I don't get what the betrayal is.
Yeah, I mean, I think to, without necessarily taking sides in terms of deciding whether or not I agree with it, I think to try and explain how it's built into that position is because I think there's been a sense, and probably a broadly accurate sense, that over the last 2 or 3 years at least, and I think you can probably go back all the way to 2015, this has been a club that's been declining at boardroom level, that's made a series of dreadful decisions, that Messi has warned about this repeatedly, that if you watch Barcelona play endlessly, you see a breakdown, a disintegration of the whole thing, with Messi kind of trying to hold it all together on his own. And I genuinely do think it's a worthwhile conversation now to talk about Messi's culpability in this whole process. But there is this kind of building sense, and it's been building for a very long time. And that's the other thing. This isn't a one-off, right? This isn't something that's just happened now and Messi's thrown his toys out of the pram. This is Rome. This is Anfield. This is Lisbon against Bayern Munich. It's Paris. It's Turin against Juventus. And all of those, by the way, Messi was playing.
They're not sending out, we've signed a player from the Championship to play in this game. I mean, they have thrown money at the problem. They've sacked managers who Messi didn't seem to have gone on with particularly. I mean, what did he want them to do other than just be better at their jobs? I mean, is that the issue?
I think that's part of it, be better at their jobs, absolutely. And as you say, they've thrown money at it. But I think that makes it worse, not better. Because there's a sense that who are you throwing money at? How much are you throwing money at? The level of incompetence has been baffling at times. And I think that's why it's been built into this thing, because there's been a sense that, you know, Messi has been fabulously well paid. And of course, that focus, that perspective will start to come through in the way that people respond to this now. But the look at it has been Messi has performed at a level that you almost cannot ask him to do more. Although there are those who now say, well, hang on, he could have done a bit more in Lisbon. He should have done a bit more in Rome. Maybe if he'd finished a couple of his chances at Anfield. Although, for what it's worth, I think in the first half at Anfield, he was absolutely brilliant. I think if you watch that game back, we forget this, but he actually played brilliantly. And so I think there's the sense that this is the one person actually doing his job at this level. And if only everyone else could do their job at anything like the level he did. And so there is a sense that this is a guy who's been there since he was 13, who could have walked away sooner and didn't, who was given a claw to walk away free 3 years ago now, and twice kind of swallowing it, saying, like, OK, carry on. And I think there's been this kind of cumulative effect that it's amazing that he hasn't gone sooner, I think some people believe. And now he's just kind of done what, frankly, a lot of people probably would have done before.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Sid.
Pleasure. Cheerio.
OK, Europa League mad fixture alert. AC Milan are heading to Dublin to play Shamrock Rovers. Barry, surely Rovers would have wanted to play this fixture with the Italian giants in front of fans, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great draw for Rovers, and it's also a terrible draw because AC Milan are the away team. UEFA give them all the TV rights apart from the Irish domestic ones, which Rovers get. So what should have been a bumper payday for Rovers, their stadium in Talla in Dublin holds 8,000. People thought, oh, they might move it to Lansdowne Road, but they've had glamour ties in the past that they haven't moved to Lansdowne Road. They like playing in Talla. So they're not going to get any money out of it, and they're probably going to lose. But Zlatan Ibrahimovic is off to Talla, which will be a treat for him. There's previous in this. AC Milan have played a European tie in Ireland before. In 1975, arrived to play Athlone Town in a horrible little ground called St. Mel's Park, or certainly horrible at the time. I don't know what it's like now. Not too far from where I grew up, actually. And Athlone Town held them to a scoreless draw in the first leg of that game, with their player John Minnock famously missing a penalty, which could have led to a remarkable first leg victory. And then AC Milan beat them 3-0 at the San Siro. But yeah, a great draw for Shamrock Rovers, and an awful shame that the game will be played behind closed doors.
I enjoy how these things get billed and how they get portrayed internationally. And the headline in Gazzetta dello Sport was that Milan had been drawn against the Juventus of Ireland. And I wanted to get Faz's reaction to that.
I wouldn't say they're the Juventus of Ireland. They're probably the AC Milan of Ireland, to be honest. Not as good as they used to be. Oh, and a note to all British football reporters. It's Shamrock Rovers' first mention, Rovers' second mention. I think the last time when they were drawn against Spurs a few years ago, I kept reading references to this team called Shamrock, which made me grind my teeth. But I used to go and watch them a lot when I was in Dublin, because they played in Talca Park quite near me when they're back in the days when they were homeless and renting from someone else. And I wish them all the very best.
Talking of that, Nicky, Ross Hamilton asks, can Zlatan do it on a cold Thursday night in Talla?
I have a hunch that he probably can. I was very much on the Zlatan sceptical. I don't know if it's bandwagon's the right word, but I was definitely Zlatan sceptical when he came back to Milan. I didn't think that was a smart move for the club that was sort of building this youth movement that was going in a different direction. But actually, I have to say, the last 6 months at Milan, he's played really well. And I expect that he'll probably score some goals in that tie, if he plays, unless Milan decide to rotate the team and get some other players a chance.
So Tom Millen also asked on Twitter, any chance of a chat about Coleraine FC knocking out Maribor in the Europa League? Arguably the best ever European result for an Irish league side. Some other fixtures as well. When Jose stops talking to his agent about possible film deals, Tottenham are going to have to face Bulgarian side Lokomotiv Plovdiv. Rangers will travel to Gibraltar to play against Lincoln Red Imps. Another David and Goliath fixture, perhaps. Welsh side Barla Town have been drawn at home to 10-time Belgian champion Standard Liège as well. So some interesting fixtures coming up in the Europa League. Right, that's it for part two. Coming up in part three, Jack Grealish finally gets his first England call-up after others drop out. And with the help of BT TV, we're going to do something we've never done before, giving one of you listeners a chance to present the climax of the show in the BT TV Football Weekly Host Super Sub. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly. So on last week's show, the panel talked about Jack Grealish being left out of Gareth Southgate's England squad. And going by his Twitter account, Grealish seemed pretty disappointed with the decision. But a week later, he's been called up. Marcus Rashford and Harry Winks had to drop out. Rashford saying he was gutted, but it was just too soon for him. So will Grealish care that he was third pick, Barney, do you think?
No, I mean, I think he'll be really pleased to be picked. I'm slightly surprised it's taken so long, and I'm slightly surprised he's not more central to this. I mean, not necessarily because he's a brilliant transformative midfielder who's so much better than the other players England have available, but just I've always felt his style and what he's very good at could be well suited to international football, which is a different kind of football. It has a different pattern, a different rhythm, a different pace. And it's less intensively tactically set as club football. Everything is so drilled. Whereas sometimes in international football, there are times where you just want to sit on the ball, just hold the ball for a bit, just slow the game down. England have missed this. They've missed having 10 minutes where they simply keep the ball, which is Grealish is brilliant at. That's what he's really good at, is keeping the ball, dribbling, having it in tiny spaces. And I don't know if that's something Jordan Henderson, for example, is as good at. And there are times where they've been overwhelmed by other teams with better midfields, or where there are periods where teams like Croatia and Holland have simply had possession and overwhelmed them in the second half. And someone like Grealish is so good at protecting the ball for those more unformed periods of play, I think would be a really useful player for them. So I'm really glad he's in, and I think he's got a role he can play.
Southgate just doesn't see him in that position, though, at all. He says he's competing with Jadon Sancho, Marcus Rashford and Raheem Sterling because he sees him more on the wing. I mean, so I suppose it'll be interesting to see what he can do in training to maybe try and convince Gareth Southgate that he can play a slightly different role. So England face Iceland in Reykjavik on Saturday in their first fixture since last November, before then travelling to Copenhagen to face Denmark 3 days later. So massive opportunity for Grealish, but also first-time call-ups to England for Wolves' Connor Cody and Arsenal's Ainsley Maitland-Niles, who really impressed in the Community Shield win for Arsenal as well. And of course, England were massively lacking on the left-hand side in the original squad that Gareth Southgate selected. What do you think of those call-ups, Nikki?
Yeah, I think the way he's played late in the season for Arsenal, spilling into what is now this season, he deserves both. He deserves to be at Arsenal and to get more opportunities. And I don't see why, exactly as you've just said, when there's a gap on the left-hand side anyway, you wouldn't give him a go.
Lots of people have been calling for Wolves defender Connor Cody to be called up to the England squad. You know, he's featured for Wolves. He's played every single Premier League game for the last 2 seasons. Barney, do you think this might perhaps nod to the fact that Gareth Southgate's thinking of changing formation for the upcoming games?
It will certainly help if he wants a bit of flexibility along that way. I thought it was interesting how he, Southgate, the back three was a big thing for him going back 2 years because he wanted England to look after the ball a bit better at the back. And he gave them that ability to do that. And I think he then saw the benefits of shifting to a four, which gave him other sort of options in wide areas. But I think what he wants them to be able to do is go between those, you know, within a game, and to be his dream is kind of something very flexible. And that obviously helps that. Equally, you don't pick a player just because you want to play a certain formation. But yeah, it gives him that flexibility. Maybe that's something he's thinking of going back to.
Just finally, Southgate had to wait to see if several of his players would even be able to play, given that they were self-isolating on their return from holidays. Harry Kane, a prime example. Barry, do you think Southgate or the FA should have been stricter in banning their players from going abroad, bearing in mind the short turnaround?
Well, I'm not sure they can ban them from going abroad. I mean, these are grown men. If they want to go abroad in their downtime, let them, however ill-advised it is. I mean, I think Harry Kane was, and many other footballers were daft to go abroad on holidays at this time, because you simply don't know what the situation is going to be when you come back. And if you have to do 2 weeks of isolation, that's your sort of pre-season wrecked. And it's going to be very detrimental to the team. But at the end of the day, these are grown men, so you can't mollycoddle them to within an inch of their lives.
I'm totally baffled by any footballer going on holiday in this short break, given that their existence, the entire existence of their profession right now, is predicated on keeping it biosecure and uninfected, given that's where clubs' income comes from, where their own income comes from, where all the people employed at those clubs' income comes from. I mean, I didn't go on holiday this year because I could see there was going to be problems with quarantine. I didn't want to have to come back and affect what happened to my family. So why are footballers whose entire, you know, life, livelihood of the sport that employs them is based on this, not saying, okay, I won't go to Greece this year? I don't get it. I know they're grown-ups, we mustn't molly, but I don't think it's a very grown-up decision. I think it's bizarre, and I think probably someone should have a word and say, I don't think that was a very good idea.
I think that's a really good point, Barney. Right, moving on. Now, with the help of BT TV, we're going to do something we've never done before on this show, because this week, two deserving Football Weekly listeners have won themselves a chance to present the climax of the show in the BT TV Football Weekly Host Super Sub. Right, now, with the help of BT TV, we're going to do something that we've never done before on the show. This week, two deserving Football Weekly listeners have won themselves a chance to present the climax of the show in the BT TV Football Weekly Host Super Sub. So just like Sheringham and Solskjaer for Man United in the Champions League final in 99, or David Fairclough perhaps for Liverpool in the European Cup in 77, when a late canny substitution can make all the difference, I'm going to be heading off shortly down the metaphorical concrete tunnel, leaving one of our listeners 5 minutes to captain the UK's greatest football pod and ask the most knowledgeable football panel out there whatever they want about the game. So that's coming up in just a moment. But what's the inspiration for this? Well, BT TV is flexible and allows football fans like you unlimited substitutions, so you can change your football packages every month. You can now get the Now TV Sky Sports Pass, BT Sport and Prime Video, so you can sub all the football on and off every month. You can search BT TV after the show to find out more. And since we put the call out on the show a couple of weeks ago, hundreds of you have written in with your pitches for why we should choose you to guest present. Well, we've read all of them and whittled them down as well, and today is the turn of our very first BT TV Football Weekly Host Super Sub, Gregor Chalmers. Gregor, fantastic to have you with us. How are you doing? How did you get to this point in the first place? How long have you been a Football Weekly fan?
Good morning. I'm very well, thank you. I've probably been listening to the show for the last 3-4 years and really probably got into it in the last couple. I spent some time in hospital, and the pod and the panel were good company in those times as well.
Barry Glendening and his bedside manner, really?
Yeah. firm but fair, and yeah, made me see that there was worse things in the world than what I was going through. So
just to be clear, Gregor, you really got to like the pod just as Max took over, is that right?
Yeah, I'm probably one of the hipster new age. I'm not an original fan as such.
Can you tell us a bit more about your competition entry? Because you said that the team Football Weekly is the Rangers side of 2012-13. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't that when Rangers weren't very good?
Yes, that was our first season in sort of post-administration liquidation life. So we were way down in the third division of Scottish football. And I think it was an interesting time. I think, you know, when writing the submission, you're trying to find a linchpin, you know, to base an idea around. And I think I settled on Max Rushton being a proxy for Ali McCoist, you know, successful footballer come media personality.
So you suggested that Barry would take on the Lee McCulloch role. Why is that?
Grizzled veteran captain, leading the sort of young pups through a turbulent time.
I feel as if the panel are in completely safe hands, having had that chat. So I'm going to hand it completely over to you, Gregor. Good luck and enjoy.
Okay, guys. If and when crowds are allowed back into stadiums in bigger numbers, do you think what's happened to us as a society over the last few weeks and months will mean less people wanting to travel longer distances, and therefore the bigger stadiums will be less full?
I think that's a really interesting question, and it's something that I have been thinking about as well. I mean, when you go to Anfield, for example, a lot of people have travelled a long way to get there, even if it's just hopping across, the Irish Sea. I mean, people obviously do have an urge to do that. People want to do it and are willing to pay for it. But it's been a slight conflict even at some clubs that you have this slight divide in support. There are a lot of tourists in stadiums, I mean, in the most literal sense, and also in the sense of people who just live some way away but follow the team and want to support them. It's definitely going to hit club revenues from that perspective.
I think you can look at other sports like the NFL, where they've already been having this problem for years of diminishing crowd numbers because it's really expensive to watch a game live and people really like the TV product. The sport is as popular as ever, but the attendance in stadium isn't. The Premier League hasn't dealt with that yet, but I can see it happening for certain.
I have a feeling that as soon as people are allowed to go back en masse, the stadiums will be full, and that the first round of games when people are allowed back will be a massive occasion. And you can just imagine the roar that will go up when that the ref blows the whistle, signal for kickoff. Fans, certain fans have maybe lost interest in or developed new ways of keeping themselves entertained during lockdown, and say dissatisfied Newcastle fans who, I'm only using them as an example because they are famously unhappy with their owner and the football their team plays, who have been going along just purely out of habit, actually go, you know what, I can't be bothered. I don't want to go back because I'm not getting value for money. I don't enjoy myself on a Saturday afternoon. And I've discovered that walking the dog for 3 hours is more fun, you know. So it will be interesting to see what happens.
Okay, thanks for that, guys. Staying with the sort of Premier League then, I was having a look the other day, and assuming no sackings, no resignations in the next 2 weeks or so, the 20 managers that take charge of the 20 Premier League clubs will have been in the job for an average of 2.8 years, so 3 years effectively, three seasons. Obviously, we're not going to see the likes of another Alex Ferguson again with that kind of tenure, but is 3 years, three seasons, is that long enough for a manager in a top flight job nowadays to kind of almost come in and be successful? Is that a fair time to judge success of a manager, or do they need longer?
In terms of is 3 years a fair time to judge someone, I think that's a really sort of difficult thing to put an absolute yardstick on, because if in 3 years as a football club you have not achieved your goals for 3 years solid, then likely there are financial ramifications of that. There are player ramifications of that. There are knock-on impacts that go all the way through a club. And so, of course, you have to sort of wrestle with those as a club. Clubs are wrestling in a very sort of immediate environment financially.
I wrote a book about this. I was just looking at it now. In the 1920s, managers tended to stay on average just under 4 years. 1992-93 season, that had fallen to 2.72 years. When I wrote this book in 2010, the average period in the job was 1.72 years. So, I mean, the sacking of managers goes back as long as managers have been in existence. So I think the fact is, if you look at even the sort of biggest clubs, if you have a really good structure in place at the top, and if you have a good procurement, proper funding, if the clubs run properly, a manager's job suddenly becomes 200% easier, and you end up not having to sack people.
I just expressed my grievance that I was thrown to first for a really waffly answer, and then Barney comes in with, I've literally written the book on this.
Yeah, it wouldn't have taken Wilson that long to mention he'd written a book on it if he was here. But I think it's no coincidence that Jurgen Klopp, say, and Pep Guardiola are probably the two most successful managers in the Premier League. Jose Mourinho might beg to differ in terms of trophies won, but working at the moment, and everything at their clubs has been put in place, from recruitment to funding, training facilities. Everything has been done to make their jobs as easy as possible, tailored specifically for them. That's probably not a coincidence.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's really good segue then, because my next question was going to be about the transfer window, and you know, you're all saying that the setup of a club is much more important, and how it's run and the structure behind the scenes. So it's clear that, you know, this transfer window, Chelsea have went out and spent big, you know, Sancho to Man United will be the kind of dominating story that might linger on and on and on. Are there any transfers that have come in, you know, a bit under the radar, not necessarily back page news, that have impressed you, you know, across Europe? And also, which clubs, assuming some don't spend, which clubs you see as being best set up to kind of survive on their own resources for the next, you know, year or 2 years in terms of backroom staff and depth of squad and academies?
It is going to be a really interesting season in terms of how people cope with the new, very strange normal. For example, I think Liverpool are going to be really fascinating because, I mean, as everybody says and knows, they haven't really bought a significant player for 2 years. But does that matter, given that the 11 is so strong? And they're obviously very interested in the young players they've got coming through as well. So I'm really interested in, you've got a champion team, the club world champions, who are looking at their own young players to actually play an active part in the squad. That can be really interesting. I think I'm interested how that will work.
Yeah, I think it's certainly comical the way people were saying that clubs would not have money to spend, and just the amount of money being thrown around, particularly by Chelsea, is remarkable, really. And obviously then Leo Messi to Crystal Palace, I imagine, is a formality waiting to happen.
Sure. Well, speaking of Messi, in the Yogurt Pots for Hats section, Messi's news has obviously dominated in the last few days and will no doubt rumble on. He obviously told Barcelona that he wanted to leave via Burofax. If the panel today were going to announce their departure from the pods, how would they choose to do so and why?
Well, I won't leave. They'll have to drag me out kicking and screaming. I wouldn't go for the big announcement, the grand gesture, or, you know, I'd just go off the radar. I'd stop taking calls. I'd stop answering. I'd leave the WhatsApp group. What could be better than that? Barry has left the group.
Barney, how about you?
I'm probably just going to do it. I think I'm leaving. I've left. I've gone. Bye.
I slightly want to give exactly the answer Paz just gave. I think I'd just disappear happily, but maybe I'd send my dog around with a little note in his mouth, which wouldn't get there because he'd get lost like as soon as he left the front door.
Well, guys, thank you very much for that. That's been really fun to be here and join you all for that. So thank you very much. And I'll hand back to Faye.
Gregor, that was absolutely fantastic. Super sub. I think I'm surplus to requirements. So thank you very much. And I'm sure Max Rushton will have you as a super sub on his football team at some point. Remember to check out BTTV online now. It's flexible with unlimited substitutions. You can get the Now TV Sky Sports Pass, BT Sport and Prime Video. So you can change your football package every month. Thank you so much again, as always, Nicky Bandini, Barney Ronne, and of course, Barry Glendenning. We'll be back on Thursday with Barry, Jonathan Wilson and Lars Sivertsen. What a lineup. And also another BTTV Football Weekly host super sub.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.